to be able to do that, and that's a luxury.
I wonder if like the U-Wrap model, did you ever use U-Wrap at Berkeley?
I was one.
Yeah, where you post a project.
Oh, well, I was,
mean, that's how they do it in Europe, right? I mean, for graduate students, they post a project and they apply to those projects. Isn't that how, I mean, I know that's how Oslo brings in a lot of their graduate students. They post a project and they apply for that project as a graduate student, and that's their graduate work.
That's also a very privileged position. Like the amount of funding that PhD students have there and postdocs have there.
But I'm just thinking as a model, is there a way to attract the right people by, you know, putting out a project in some sort of, you know, like a research agenda clearinghouse?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one way. I'm trying to think of like the next phase for this project, and maybe would another phase for the project be applying for some sort of fellowship funding stream to do something like what you're describing at the Turing Institute, of saying, okay, we've had that, a lot of that conversation in the last 2 days, but you know, it takes longer than 2 days to kind of hatch some sort of research agenda that would be mutually beneficial.
I mean, can I also ask what people's experience is of, like, personally, my most successful collaborations, intellectually, grant-seekingly, productively, like multiple people being satisfied with the results for different disciplines, has all been based on interpersonal connection. Like Chris and I were friends before we had a productive collaboration, so like I definitely admire and see the value of the radical collaboration model at the Turing. I can also see going to an elaborate effort to set up this like interdisciplinary like finding research projects data, and it's still just people who get on with each other.
The hiring process was all about them thinking, about would we all get along together.
So that's engineered,
I mean, in addition to everything, but like it
into
was very
the team
much about
before
putting a team together.
Okay. And David, I saw you nodding.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll think all the best.
I have to be before 30.
Okay.
Yeah, I think a lot of the best work that I've done has been in collaboration with people where the collaboration grew out of a personal connection that we had already. I'm just like having met the person at conferences and talking over a period of years before working together. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's also the other way around. I only work with people I like.
Yes.
And there's no other way of working. And if I don't like somebody, I just know. I avoid it.
All right, so Teresa has to leave.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm about to put a pin in the existential problem.
That's good.
Assuming we're going to now jump ahead to assuming we've built the whole thing and it's been a smashing success.
Yes.
Then what? Because many projects
Party.
Don't have that at the outset of thinking about the longevity question, and so now we want to turn toward the question of the longevity of a project. Yeah.
So I will say, too, I have to go run and catch my flight, but it was great meeting everybody and chatting with everyone over this last 2 days.
Thank you.
Yeah.
David.
Safe flight.
David, could you please email me your slides?
Slides are already on that computer, because I projected from there.
Still on the computer.
And if not, then I guess I don't know.
I think it wipes.
It wipes.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
it wipes.
Yeah, I could do that.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to keep mine at 10 minutes. I have to. 4:30, I have to go. All right, so we're going to talk about data preservation and software a bit too. Although really, data preservation starts at the very beginning of the process and it has to happen throughout the entire project. So we're really going to talk, give a quick overview of what the data lifecycle is. Maybe not the best, but you can see it. So, I mean, there's lots of different images and like forms that people come up with to show this, but essentially, you know, you have the research planning stage, which you guys are kind of in the process of doing right now, and have already done some of this stuff. So it's project proposal, project startup, and a lot of things that you have to consider during this time, your funder, what is the NEH group wanting of you, because there's nothing else, you gotta follow the requirements. You wanna make sure that you're complying with any necessary codes. This is one that they had. You need to consider legal issues. One question I have for y'all, is anyone claiming any copyright in this stuff? Okay, so that is much easier for us, thank goodness. It just makes life a lot easier. And then also, you want to think forward about, or like, are you using existing data, which is what we are doing here. And then you have the active state of research when you're collecting, processing, and analyzing the data. So things that we need to think about is how are we going to store and back up the data during the project? How do you share the data with collaborators, especially when they're across, you know, different institutions? Access control management, I don't know if that is a big of a concern here, because we're not really dealing with sensitive data, unless like there are ethical issues with the data, of course, but we're not talking like HIPAA issues or like personally identifiable. Everyone's dead from this. And then obviously metadata documentation, which we talked about yesterday, and that ties so big into preservation and maintenance of this stuff. So you always want to think about the two together. And then also at the end, that's when we talk about sharing results, and that's publishing the results. And that's, you know, we talked about this again a little bit too yesterday, so I'm hoping this might actually be easy. What data repositories are out there that you can share this to? What do you think about and need to think about in choosing a data repository? How do we make sure that when we are publishing articles based on this data, we are connecting our article and the data together, people can cite the data for, you know, we get credit for it, and, you know, it's just good to be able to have people cite your data. And then again, is the data licensed properly so that other people can reuse the data? It sounds like that should not be a problem with this project, which is great. And then finally, long-term preservation. So it's all, it's a big world. Things that you need to consider, especially at the start and, you know, as you go through, and this is a whole iterative project or process, I mean, so you can come up with a data management plan at the beginning, but you're probably going to be revisiting that plan throughout because you're going to have to make changes, and that's just how it goes. What types of data are being produced? Here it sounds like we already have a lot of the data. It's going to be images, text, maybe some XML. Are there any PDFs to be thinking about? Or audio? It sounds like there's audio because of this. So the different types of files, who's doing the work, when is it being done, how is it being done, who's responsible for the data itself, that might change throughout the process. Something as simple as a file naming system can actually be really big. It doesn't need to be anything elaborate, and you would think most people know how to do this, but you need a file naming system if you haven't thought of that before, because it's going to make your life a thousand times easier, and everyone's lives. Is the data going to be reviewed for quality, especially if you're going to curate the data and upload it to a repository? And how is that data going to be reviewed for quality? Where is it going to be stored? And is the data properly described through metadata, a README file, and or a code book? I think someone mentioned this yesterday about how, you know, people will upload their data and then there's not enough information to actually know how to use that data. So when we talk about metadata, yesterday we were talking about, you know, for the individual items in this collection, but we also need metadata to describe the overall collection so that if someone comes along and wants to upload it, they know, they understand how to use it. Okay. When it comes to sharing your data, and sharing is kind of goes hand in hand with the preservation and maintenance, because, you know, most of the time it's someone else who's going to be doing that for you. There's a standard that's been kind of coming up in the past few years called FAIR, which basically stands for findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. So when we share data, ideally it's going to meet this standard. By findable, they mean that both metadata and the data have a unique persistent identifier. That can be different things. It could be a PERMA URL, but I think generally kind of what's preferred is the DOI, the Digital Object Identifier. Just because while it's not a 100% perfect system, it works a lot better than most anything else. So any way you can get a DOI is the best. Data have rich metadata. So again, this is what we talked about yesterday, so I won't spend too much time on it. And the metadata are in a searchable resource, which can be as simple as wherever you uploaded it to gets crawled by Google and Google Scholar. It doesn't have to be terribly more complicated than that, although it can be if you want it to be. It just depends on who is your desired audience, where you think they're going to go to most likely, and things like that. So accessible, again, we're talking about both the metadata and the data are retrievable by identifier using standardized communications protocol, which is getting to the more technical stuff beyond me. It sounds like you guys, or at least some of you guys, are more familiar with that. Metadata, accessible even when data isn't. So, we can't promise our data is always going to be up there for eternity,
Maybe we're only going to promise it'll be up there for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, however long. But even when the data goes away, it's really best if the metadata continues to exist, so that people at least know this existed at one time. And maybe, if they're fortunate, there's a contact information and the metadata, and they know who to contact, and hopefully they haven't died yet. Yeah, happens a lot. All right, interoperable. So again, this both of these pertain to both metadata and the data. So it uses formal, accessible, shared, and broadly applicable language for knowledge representation. Again, standards. Vocabularies that follow FAIR principles. We were just talking about this all yesterday. This is why, you know, sticking with Dublin Core can be a really good thing, because a lot of people know Dublin Core, or the Getty thesauruses, things like that. And then finally, reusable. So both, again, metadata and the data are richly described with a plurality of accurate and relevant attributes, which includes data usage license. So if this is all public domain, let's mark it with a Creative Commons public domain license. Includes detailed provenance, who collected the data, how did they collect it, what grant funders paid for the collection, what tools were used to collect it, what tools were used to process the data. Was there any code? It sounds like there's a lot of code going on. So the code needs to be with it, and that all needs to be part of it. Meet domain relevant community standards. So that's something that is more your area of expertise. I don't know if there's a ton out there for the humanities as far as this goes. I think a lot of this work has been more in the sciences and the social sciences. This does tend to focus more on the qualitative, you know, your traditional numerical data. But yeah, if there are community standards out there for history and whatnot, try and meet those. Okay, so that's basically the concept of FAIR. I have 2 minutes. All right, so you're gonna wanna pick a repository. What do you need to consider in picking a repository? Some of things are easy. Can you afford it? What long-term preservation do they offer? Some repositories, you can upload it, and as long as they exist, maybe it'll be there, but are they actually going to try and take care of your files? Because we all know there's obsolescence when it comes to technology. Files are going to degrade over time. So what are they actually going to do to try and make sure that this is for the good, for the long term? Will it provide enough for people to use your data? Again, some places you upload your data to, and there's no requirements other than you upload one file set. They don't require like a codebook or a README file or anything like that. And so there's a lot of data going up that it's great, it's up there, but can people actually reuse it? So at least, at the very least, the data repository needs to allow you to provide that information. What user support is available? Again, if this is something that you're doing more yourself, then you might have questions, you might need help. What are the funder journal requirements? I looked at the NEH the general data management plan. They do not have any preference for a data repository. They made no mention. They actually specifically say that they don't select anyone. But then again, if you're wanting to submit to a journal later on, more and more journals are starting to have requirements that you must deposit in a specific place. Will the repository help show the impact of your work? A lot of this is going to also be if they give you a DOI, because one of the benefits of a DOI is, you know, things like altmetrics is based on DOI. And will they also allow you to see download counts, view counts, things like that, and they're not always perfect, but it helps you make the argument for what impact your data is having. What are the terms and conditions? I know, they're really boring, but a good data repository will hopefully won't have like some horrible to read set of terms and conditions. And it's just good to know what you're signing on to. And then finally, what are the fees? Because some of them you don't have to pay, but some of them you do. Oh, I went over by 17 seconds. Shoot. Okay, so we talked about these yesterday, but just to quickly go over, we do have a repository here at UNR, ScholarWorks. I'm not gonna click on these unless you want me to. The biggest problem with ScholarWorks is, like I said, we don't mint DOIs here. I also don't think we have the best preservation policy, to be quite honest. We're just too new. We're still in the getting started phase. So while I think you can use ScholarWorks, I would recommend relying only on ScholarWorks. So then, what are your other options? We do have, so there are a ton of domain-specific repositories. I've done some looking and I just haven't seen any that looks really good for this specific data set. There is one, are you guys familiar with, is it Humanities Common? Do you know?
It's all right.
So the biggest issue with Humanities Common is why you can't upload data. The cap is 100 megabytes. And they do say you can contact them if you have more. But my guess is this is really big and I don't know if they're going to support it. So outside of that, you would then probably look to just a general data repository. The two that I am most familiar with, and that I, you know, they're both nonprofits, are Zenodo and Dataverse. Zenodo is out of Europe. It's very well respected. I've uploaded several data sets to it myself. They have a cap of about, I believe, 50 gigabytes. And then after that, I think you have to contact them, but it's free for up to 50 gigabytes. It's pretty good. You can do, I think you can do versioning. There's a pretty good support. Dataverse is out of Harvard. I haven't actually uploaded any data to it, but just looking at the website, their policies are very clear. They have a policy for preservation. They have a policy for if you, basically, I mean, you're not really, they don't want you removing your data. Most of these places don't, but there's a process to go through it if you do want to say, I need to take down my data for whatever reason. Both of them meant DOIs. I have not seen anything on Dataverse as far as a cap. I kind of think they might, like, you know, there's probably some point, but they're not making it clear what point it is that, you know, you need to talk with them if your data gets too big.
And the Dataverse domain, isn't that focused on the sciences? No?
So you can, I mean, anyone can upload it to Dataverse.
Yeah.
It's anyone.
Yeah, Berkeley had some objection to Dataverse.
Oh, really?
What it was.
Okay.
They went with Dryad.
Dryad?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a possibility.
Actually, all of UC went with Dryad.
I'm not as familiar with Dryad. Is that one where anyone can upload, or do you have to have an institutional?
I think it's an institutional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We don't hear at UNR.
But
so.
It also connects with a lot of the publications.
Okay.
Yeah, so all the
if,
publishers
if,
and stuff. So,
if
anyway.
There's a partner in this grant who has access to Dryad, that's certainly one you can consider. We don't hear at UNR. Somebody, I think maybe you mentioned ICPSR yesterday. Somebody, okay. You can do ICPSR. It's social science quantitative data is what it specializes in, so I don't entirely know how appropriate it is for this data set. There's multiple ways you can upload to ICPSR. You can do what's called an open, and it's just you upload, and they're not doing anything. Then you can do what's called the curated model. Curated model, you're going to get a lot more help. They will provide like everything full service. The issue with doing the curated is you can either do it if you have a membership, which we do right now, or you'd have to pay for it. There's a good chance we're going to lose our ICPSR membership. It's $20,000, and we had like very few users last year. So I can't promise that ICPSR membership will be available to you, but you can contact them and see how much it's going to cost. And if you think you want to go that route, then you could build it into the grant. So I went over, but okay, sorry. I kept it pretty close to 10. So that's kind of the big overview. A lot of things to consider. I really didn't go into everything. I try to keep it fairly short and sweet. Questions?
So, I mean, is everybody kind of clear on what the difference between a data repository is and a box?
Oh, yeah. I am making some assumptions, so if there's stuff that you're like, wait, what?
Yeah, because the data repositories are actually doing some sort of preservation actions on your files, you know, and so they're checking.
But where does, so there's the processing code, and that can be stored. And then there's the code for whatever tool or presentation that you build. But what's the solution to some trying to archive, and then the kind of maintenance question of it, the actual public-facing product that you've made?
And that gets a lot harder.
Yeah.
Well, the public, yeah. I mean, it depends on how dynamic that public-facing publication is. If it's fairly static, it can be archived as a web archive. And actually, a lot of early digital projects are being web archived just to preserve them, and the whole underlying websites are going away.
Well, because this is going, I guess, tying into some of the open source tools. Like, if you build an applet in D3, it's purely dynamic. And so if browsers get, you know, 15 years from now, D3 is no longer supported, it's, you know, it's different than, say, like Flash because it's running native, but it goes that route. Would that be an argument for actually rethinking what you should be producing and using something like Jekyll and just making straight HTML style pages that will be able to be read regardless for all of posterity? Like,
yeah.
But that would require a dramatic scaling back of interactivity of the product.
Right, and if you talk to most systems offices and libraries, that's what they're recommending. They're just like, keep it HTML, because that's a thing they'll support long term,
and
keep active. They won't support a lot of these other sites. They'll just say, mm-mm.
There are levels, right? When libraries create our online exhibits, often we recognize that those are not going to be around forever. They will go away, because trying to preserve them is just not, we don't have the resources. But if we can, you know, build it and we have this exhibit and it is up for, you know, like a decent period of time and it gets used, we still see that it's successful. And then at the underlying data behind it, if that is preserved for a much longer future, right? So that if other people want to take it and they want to build some new interface onto it. Actually, you know, when you were talking about the whole issue with GUIs versus maybe just providing code and doing stuff in a more reproducible way, I was like, yes. Because it's much easier to preserve. It's not that it can't be preserved, but you're probably not going to be preserving it here. You might need to partner with like an archive or a library or some other group that will be, like there is a software preservation network that does a lot of this stuff. But a lot of what they're dealing with and their struggles is they're preserving software made by other people when they don't necessarily have the permission to do so. So that right there is actually really easy for us because we're all here, you can give the rights for them, someone to do that, it doesn't have to be a big issue. But copyright is big for a lot of software preservation.
One of the big conversations when I was at D-Lab, and I don't think it's been solved yet, is if you're preserving the code that generated the results that you're sharing to be reproducible, you then also need to preserve the libraries and the environment it was run on, right? Because like, as R changes, and as the packages for R changes, you can actually run the exact same R code in a different version of R and get a rather different graph depending on which version of the package, which core version of R you're running.
So the Turing projects use Binder Hub,
mm-hmm.
which creates, it's like something better than Docker.
I was about to say,
I'm
like
not
Docker.
The person to explain it, but that's
yeah.
what they use for creating those environments, preserving the environment.
Yeah. Docker is another. Yeah. That gets done. But yeah, as things, you know, change, it's very hard to, you know, as the technology, underlying technologies change. You know, things get obsolete fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Which
but
is why
you decouple the, you know, the content from the display as much as possible.
And that's also, I think I probably, I don't even know if I specifically said this, but I know I talked with you previously about this. That is why it's so important to use the non-proprietary file formats to
yeah.
make sure that as software programs and other programs go out, people can still use it. And so I know there was a lot of talk yesterday about hating on XML. I haven't had to deal with XML much, so I don't really know. I mean, it looks confusing to me too, I can tell you that. As a non-metadata person, but it needs to be in some kind of a general format like that, whether it's a text file or XML or TIFF for images.
Yeah. You basically just want to use standard file formats
yeah.
for everything you're doing because they will be migratable
yeah.
if
yeah.
they change. I mean, TIFF hasn't changed in 30 years, so it's a pretty stable standard. PDF.
Very, yeah.
You know, there's.
EPS.
Hmm?
EPS.
I don't know much about it. I know about EPS from a long time ago. yeah. But yeah, as, I mean, again, as, when you talk about the standards you want to use and the, you know, in coding, it's like, you know, why you would not develop your own XML versus using some very pared down version of TEI is because TEI is a recognized and known standard.
Right.
And so interoperability with other TEI, you know, corpora, you know, it's going to be much higher, you know, if you are using something that everybody else is using. It's just, yeah, that's how it works. If you use one-off weird tools, that's going to make keeping the stuff going much more difficult.
How are you managing that? Because it seems like there's certain things that the available packages will do, and there's some things that the packages won't do. I guess one route would be right to if you fork a package or you build enough custom functions for a package. At that point, you either become a developer and contributor on that package, or you develop perhaps a forked package that then could itself be preserved alongside, like, what, or is it just an argument for thinking of what's possible in the existing?
Actually, at the moment, I develop for, it's more for research, so it's not tools that it's available out of the box like this and that you can reuse directly. So for the moment, we didn't thought too much about this preservation stuff. So because each time we don't have all the time that we want, so we develop things to see, okay, just to see if it works. And so we didn't have time yet to say, okay, it works now, we will do things right. But at the end we need that, but for the moment it's just research in progress, so we just test things. And
most of this you don't have to, I mean, some of it you have to think about as you're going along, but some of it you can either transform data into a standardized format at the end, or, you know, I mean, there's a lot of ways that you can, you know, when you think about, okay, we're not going to preserve all this stuff that we created. This is what we want to preserve.
Well, that was kind of my next question.
Decide.
Is this an unnecessary requirement? I mean, to try to preserve everything at that level. When a historian goes to the archive, they don't preserve. I mean, presumably there's some trace of it in the footnotes or endnotes, but nobody preserves every decision that was made in a way that was purely reproducible. But the expectation, oftentimes, whenever it becomes quantitative or kind of neighboring the sciences, is that the benefits of versioning control and R and the such is that it would be theoretically reproducible 10 years, 20 years from now. Is that an expectation we should bring to bear on a humanities project? Or should we be thinking more along the lines of just preserving the data and preserving the end product and maybe making an effort, but not necessarily giving so much thought to having to preserve through BinderHub or Docker the exact environment and the precise library in which that we use?
I think it is important.
Yeah.
I think this is the new standard, and I think if you don't do it, it's going to become increasingly seen to be a problem. Just read all the replies to Nancy Da's article, and right, it's that. I mean, that's what we're doing, and we have, everything has to be reproducible. We feel a huge burden of access to public funding, and if we do something that is hidden in any way, that will be a giant black stain on the project.
Well, and not to not problematize the historian in the archive either, because I've never asked him, but I've been told never, like, to ask Merriman about what he thinks about Weber and his use of the archive.
Uh-huh. Well, any historian working before 1968 probably did very questionable things when writing about the things that they did or did not see in archives.
Including writing on the documents themselves.
Mm-hmm. I will say,
if you look at the data management plans, those can kind of help you frame what you want to.
There's a really good examples out there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's a start. I mean, not all data management plans are the same, but
You can look at NEH-specific ones.
Yeah, and that'll give you a sense of what you should be doing, what you want to be doing, and how you would document a scholarly project like this, a digital humanities project. You know, again, that's kind of actually being looked at right now by Katrina Fenland. And that will be something that, you know, they're going to have a data model for what you should be retaining, and,
mm-hmm.
you know,